From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Lance can pedal. Heck, he can sometimes win, but not this year. Ahead on Only a Game, should Lance Armstrong be racing in the 2010 Tour de France? Also, writer and noted iconoclast Dave Zirin remembers the cantankerousness and the compassion of late New York Yankees owner George Steinbrenner. And meet the race car driver too young to get his driver's license, but old enough and talented enough to dream of NASCAR glory. Also, former Olympic track star Marion Jones resumes her athletic career on the basketball court.
Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody does, whether they admit it or not. But it's kind of what you do after that that really, you know, shows, I think, your true character. So I think in that regard, I'm certainly on the right path.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The 2010 Tour de France may go down in cycling history as Lance Armstrong's last run. The seven-time champion has had a bumpy ride almost since the beginning of the race 2 weeks ago. A couple of crashes pushed him to acknowledge the inevitable. He's not going to win this race. And that may not be the worst news Armstrong's fans have to face. Joining me now to discuss the current state of the most accomplished Tour de France rider of all time is Joe Lindsay, who has been writing about Lance Armstrong for Bicycling Magazine. Joe, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
In an article that appeared on Thursday, you say of Lance Armstrong, quote, 5 years ago, Armstrong didn't get caught in any crashes. Now he can't get out of his own way. You refer to the accidents Armstrong has been in during the current tour, but can't accidents happen to any rider?
Yeah, absolutely they can, and that honestly is one of the things that made Armstrong's run of seven straight victories so remarkable, is that he seemed to be remarkably lucky at staying out of trouble. Even in 2003, there was the famous crash where one of his competitors crashed on a descent in front of him, and he literally went off-road and rode his bike, kind of cut a switchback on a hill and rode across this big grassy field and then got back on the road. And it was one of those things that I think sort of cemented Lance's legend, as he was literally just unflappable, and so that kind of makes what we're seeing now even more stunning.
To what extent is Lance Armstrong's performance this year the result of bad luck and his own decline, and to what extent is it the result of brilliant riding by other competitors?
You know, honestly, I'd have to split it equally along all of those lines. Lance said earlier this year at the Tour of California that the riders that he would be racing against in this year's Tour de France are a level above the competitors that he raced against during his seven Tour runs. He thinks they are much more talented riders. Alberto Contador may turn out to be the best rider in history. It's entirely possible. Certainly, his age is a factor, and then certainly the luck issue plays into it big time. You know, on stage eight, he crashed three times, and the second time was his fault. He clipped a pedal going around a corner, and it happened at an extremely bad time. It was right before the second to last climb of the day. Just put him in a really bad place. When the pace started to lift even more at the front, he simply couldn't hold it.
Lance Armstrong has always denied ever using performance-enhancing drugs. The most recent charges have come from former rider Floyd Landis. What is the status of the investigation of those charges?
You know, it's very tough to get any real information. Certainly the people involved in that, which are said to be Jeff Nowitzki, who investigated Balco, and Doug Miller, who's a federal prosecutor, they're not returning phone calls, they're not talking to reporters, that kind of thing. The New York Daily News has reported that there is a grand jury and that they have issued subpoenas. The New York Times has not gone so far as to say that there's a grand jury, but did say that subpoenas have been issued to witnesses after talking with anonymous sources who've been briefed on the case.
Joe, you mention in your article inconsistencies in Lance Armstrong's replies to questions about whether he had an ownership stake in the company that controlled his previous team, U.S. Postal Service. How has he contradicted himself?
Well, he contradicted himself by saying that he never had any ownership at all in the Postal Service team. And then it turned out that there was testimony from a case in 2005, a civil case, where he said there that he had as much as a 10% ownership in the team. His attorney then came out with a statement saying that it was all a big misunderstanding, that when Armstrong testified in 2005, he thought he was an owner in the team because the board of directors of the team had agreed to grant him an ownership stake in 2004 and had told him this, but they didn't actually get around to doing it until late in 2007. So that was sort of the equivocation that at the time he thought he was, but he wasn't, and now he knows that he wasn't, so he's not.
Well, now that that's cleared up, why is whether Armstrong had an ownership in U.S. Postal Service team an important question?
Well, in terms of the federal investigation that's proceeding right now, the whole thing basically hinges on the fact that the sponsor for the team for years was the United States Postal Service, which is an arm of the federal government. So if he committed sports fraud through doping and essentially defrauded the sponsor in that sense, then he's defrauded the federal government. If Armstrong is an owner of that team, then that sort of makes him very much culpable for that. If he's just a rider, if he's just another one of the guys going along with it, then maybe not so much.
Given Lance Armstrong's misfortunes during the current tour, what do you think is the likelihood that he'll compete in the event again?
He's already said that he does not plan to compete in the tour again. And now that he's thoroughly out of contention, I think it's kind of really underlined for him that he no longer has the ability to win the race. And I think, you know, as he said when he came back, he was coming back in part to try to win an eighth tour. I don't see him sticking around just to continue to puddle along in 32nd place overall, that kind of thing. That said, it's Armstrong. He's retired before. He's walked away from the sport before. He said there was no chance he would ever be back. So you just never know.
When Armstrong's Tour de France career does end, as someday it must, will Americans care about the race anymore?
That's a really good question, because last time around they sort of didn't. The broadcast viewership numbers for the 2006 tour went down, which is fascinating because the 2006 tour also saw an American win in Floyd Landis. Sure, he was accused of failing a positive test, and ultimately that was all upheld. But during the race, there was an American leading and winning the Tour de France, ultimately winning the Tour de France, and they still didn't get the broadcast numbers back that they wanted. So, you know, there's no secret that the cyclist that most Americans know is going to be Lance Armstrong.
Joe Lindsay writes for Bicycling Magazine, and his article titled "Is Armstrong's Empire Crashing Around Him?" appeared on Thursday. Joe, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Most young motorists with learner's permits and quaking instructors alongside hone their driving skills in empty parking lots and the quieter neighborhoods. But that's not been the case for one young Virginian who might find himself at one of NASCAR's hallowed tracks before he has his photo taken at the local registry of motor vehicles. Beverly Amsler reports.
It's a quiet mid-morning in rural Southwest Virginia as a Speedway pickup pushes the black Chevrolet Monte Carlo into position on the track. But the silence is broken as the motor comes to life. The race car picks up speed and pulls away as it enters the Speedway's far turn. It's a practice run for the driver of the number 22 car here at Motor Mile Speedway in Radford, Virginia, where cars post speeds of more than 100 miles an hour. After a few minutes traveling at breakneck speed, the car slows, moves inside the track, and comes to a stop. The driver climbs out of the side window and takes off his helmet. Michael McGuire's boyish good looks reveal his age. This summer, the Vinton, Virginia native turned 14, but he's already a veteran of some of the racetracks located throughout the southeastern U.S.
We bought a go-kart when I was around 5 years old and just kind of took off from there.
Racing cars is in this teen's blood. His grandfather, Squeak McGuire, is a former driver and track owner. Michael's father, Tim, and Uncle Tony raced late model stock cars all over the East Coast.
I don't know. It looked cool. I just loved racing, I guess. I just really wanted to do it and just started in go-karts and tried to move up from there.
And move up he did. After winning go-kart races throughout the Mid-Atlantic region, Michael went to a Mod 4 car in 2008 and then to the limited sportsman car. Last year, he was the youngest driver to compete at Orange County Speedway in Rougemont, North Carolina. At 5'2", the 108-pound sixth grader won four races and was crowned the limited sportsman division champion. Now he's racing in a late-model stock car with a crate engine that he uses in the United Auto Racing Association circuit at tracks throughout the southeastern U.S. Michael says there have been a few comments about his size and age along the way.
There has been when we first started in the Mod 4, when people never even see me get in the car. There were kind of a few comments made, but when I got and they got to see me drive, it was understandable. They knew why I was there.
Tim McGuire says Michael's size has caused a bit of a problem because he's had to have safety equipment, such as a Nextel Cup-style seat, specially built to fit him. When Michael first started racing, he weighed just 83 pounds. Now, after a growth spurt, he's up to 118. Tim says as a parent, he's worried about Michael getting into a crash, but as a former driver, he also knows the vehicle is as safe as it can be.
The cars are built to withstand an impact, not that we ever want to see it, but when these young people get in regular passenger cars and things go awry, sometimes those cars don't hold up and people are thrown out of them. So as a parent, I'm scared when we race this, but I'm going to be even more scared when he's driving a regular car with his friends.
That day won't come for at least a couple more years. Sponsors have traditionally wanted only veteran drivers, but now younger and younger children are climbing into the driver's seat. Joey Logano became the youngest driver to win a nationwide series race at just over 18 years of age. And last winter, NASCAR lowered its minimum racing age from 16 to 14. Michael McGuire celebrated his 14th birthday last month by finishing third in his first NASCAR start. Mike Stevens covered NASCAR for a Virginia television station for more than 20 years. He says while Michael might be part of that youthful trend, he drives well beyond his years.
He started in the karting circuit, made great inroads there, was a tremendous success, and then just made the transition effortlessly to these bigger, heavier, harder to drive cars, and actually he believes they're easier to drive, which is amazing to me.
Stevens believes Michael has all the ingredients to be successful in the NASCAR circuit.
Michael McGuire has the name McGuire that's respected well in Virginia racing circles, but he also has skill, maybe more so than his dad or uncle or even his grandfather had. I've been really impressed with the fact that for a young kid, he carries himself very well. He's extremely humble. He's respectful. He's really good, too. He's really good when he's driving.
As for the future, Michael admits he probably won't be the youngest driver in NASCAR.
I think Joey Logano kind of took that away. But I don't want to go in the NASCAR really, really early. Like, I want to enjoy my time in late models and stuff, even if I do get a chance to go and make it in NASCAR.
In the winter, when Michael's not on the track, you can find him on the ice. He's a defenseman for a local hockey team that his dad coaches. But all his success comes with a price. Michael doesn't have a girlfriend. He says he used to, but points out that you have to sacrifice to be a top driver. For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke, Virginia.
To view Beverly's Michael McGuire photo gallery, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Swimmers using public pools in Austria are free to practice the crawl, the backstroke, or the butterfly, but they have been asked to keep their mouths shut. Officials at the pools have estimated that visitors to the 18 pools in Vienna swallow about 1,300 gallons of water per day, and they say use of the pools has increased during this summer's heat waves. In an earlier attempt to conserve water, Austrian pool managers have tried to ban Bermuda shorts because the garments absorb more water than skimpier swim trunks. The next step would seem to be the elimination of suits, which would be okay because the swimmers wouldn't be allowed to open their mouths, so they couldn't laugh at each other. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Perfection or Perfidy, one man's successful quest to break The Price is Right. But first, Chicago's in the basement, not the sky, at least today. The sparks are likewise buried, merely embers in L.A. Seattle's nowise stormy, and Atlanta dreams away as summer sizzles on throughout the WNBA. One of the most interesting WNBA stories this summer comes out of Oklahoma, where former Olympic track star Marion Jones has resumed her athletic career, only this time as a guard with the Tulsa Shock, which currently owns the league's worst record. Jones served 6 months in federal prison in 2008 after her conviction for lying to federal investigators about her use of performance-enhancing drugs. Now she's hoping her play can elevate her image and her team in the standings. Only a Game's Greg Eklund recently met with Jones, and he has this report.
Locusts buzz in the small trees outside Tulsa University's Reynolds Center. At basketball practice inside are two figures who few would have imagined would ever be together on a basketball court. Former Tulsa and Arkansas head coach Nolan Richardson and former Olympic sprinter Marion Jones. They're now paired up with the WNBA's Tulsa Shock. Richardson is the general manager and head coach. Jones a reserve guard. When practice is over, Jones looks up at the white banner hanging from the ceiling, marking the University of Tulsa's 1981 NIT championship.
Does that have anything to do with my current coach?
Yes, it does.
I might know a little bit about that.
Jones spots Tulsa's NCAA Sweet 16 banner from 1994. By then, Richardson had moved on to the University of Arkansas.
Well, it's the year that the women, Carolina, won the national championship, and the same year that Arkansas won the men's championship. That I know.
Jones was a freshman, starting point guard at North Carolina that year. So much has happened since Jones last played competitive basketball 14 years ago. She's 34 now, and it's been almost 2 years since Jones was released from prison after serving 6 months for lying to federal investigators about her use of performance-enhancing drugs. She may have been stripped of her Olympic medals, but not of her desire to compete. Most of all, she says she wants to make amends.
Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody does, whether they admit it or not. But it's kind of what you do after that that really, you know, shows, I think, your true character. So I think in that regard, I'm certainly on the right path.
But why would Jones, a mother of three, content with her quiet lifestyle in Austin, Texas, want to subject herself to the public spotlight?
For somebody who's been competing at the highest level of sport for so long, and to have been removed from it or be away from it, even for a couple of years, I certainly was searching for that same type of challenge in my life, even having three kids and everything going on with me.
Ron Rappaport was a commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He profiled Jones in See How She Runs, a book published in 2000. He's pulling for Jones, but says her comeback will not be complete without full disclosure.
And if she really wants to be a role model, if she really wants to be a cautionary tale, then she needs to tell us what she did. She needs to tell us the drugs she took. She needs to tell us the actual things that she did and when she did them. But I just think it's one of the greatest of all the wasted opportunities in all of sports. This was a great, great athlete. And she threw it all away. And it's a very sad thing to see.
In the game, the Tulsa Shock, number 20, Marion Jones.
Jones has played sparingly this season, averaging just 2 points and 7 minutes a game. Richardson, however, likes the spark she provides when he puts her in the lineup.
Her energy level is so high, and we play basketball with energy the way I want to play. And when she, that's what she brings to the game. She raises the energy level.
From his days of coaching men on the collegiate level, Richardson has brought his nonstop fast-break style to his first women's team. And what better match is there than a former Olympic sprinter and a proponent of up-tempo basketball? Richardson says Jones brings a skill that's rare, even in elite female basketball players.
How many players out there that are playing basketball that are 22, 23 couldn't touch the speed and quickness of Marion at 34? It's a no-brainer when it comes to speed, quickness. And, you know, she may have lost a step in running the 100-yard dash, but that's not what we're doing out here.
What the Shock are not doing is winning. They've been neck and neck all season with the Los Angeles Sparks for the WNBA's worst record. Home attendance has tailed off since their season opening sellout. Some have wondered if the team signed Jones solely for the publicity. But her teammates agree that Jones earned her spot on the roster. Jones acknowledges that the home fans remain unconvinced about her basketball abilities.
It's more like a curiosity factor. Let's go to the game to kind of see this Marion Jones. And I look forward to the day when people are coming to the games, like, because they want to see, like, my skills. And, you know, right now I know I'm still, like, a novelty. You know, I get it.
Richardson believes there's mileage left in Jones's speedy legs. Jones says if she maintains her level of improvement while working off the rust, this will not be a one-year plan. While Richardson searches for the winning combination on the Tulsa Shock, he says Marion Jones has been a model teammate and a model citizen.
You can read all you want, and they can talk about all you want until you get to know this young lady and talk to her. You know, it's what every parent would love to have in their child.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
In September 1972, Bob Barker picked up the microphone for the new Price is Right and started giving members of the studio audience, usually nervous housewives, the chance to win.
Here is the first item up for bids on the Price is Right.
It's happening!
All the contestants had to do was guess the cash value of the prize. The contestant who was closest to the actual cost without going over won the prize and was invited up on stage to guess the prices of more prizes.
Oh, you won a washer and dryer. Isn't that exciting? And now, Betty, things will get even more exciting because you have a chance to win this.
A new car!
Can you stand it? In this case, Betty guessed poorly and went home with $171 instead of that banana yellow Toyota Corolla. That's the way the game was supposed to work. But what would happen if somebody figured out how to beat the game? That's the subject of TV's crowning Moment of Awesome, an article in the current edition of Esquire magazine by Chris Jones. Chris joins me now from Ottawa. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
The moment of awesome described in your article doesn't come until 2008, a full 38 years after The Price is Right hit the airwaves. By that point, Drew Carey was hosting the program. How much else changed in the way The Price is Right worked?
Incredibly little, I guess, would be the answer. I mean, The Price is Right is one of those games that I think has its appeal based on the fact that it never changes. That if you watched it in 1973 or you watched it in 1993 or now, it's pretty much the same show. There's this comfort of routine in it, I think.
The subject of your article is a fellow named Terry Neese, and it seems safe to say that Terry is a little bit of a character. What is it about him that made him the perfect guy to take on The Price is Right?
Terry started his professional life as a weatherman, and unlike most of today's weathermen, he actually understood weather and was very good at seeing patterns and wind lift and barometric pressure and what that meant and causes and effects. After a successful career as a weatherman, he started a second life in casino surveillance. The same kind of patterns that you would see in the weather, you would look for those in how someone bet at a blackjack table or how someone played their cards. He had a very hard time just watching people do this. He decided he was going to try to learn how to do this. So he became a blackjack card counter, and then ultimately he set his sights on The Price is Right.
All right, so Terry and his wife, Linda, set out to beat The Price is Right. How did they prepare?
They watched the show religiously. They would tape it, and Terry says that he began to see patterns. In particular, he saw that the prizes on The Price is Right repeat. You know, Rice-A-Roni or Campbell's Cream of Mushroom Soup, you see that again and again. The price is always the same. But it also applies to the bigger prizes. And he first noticed it with a barbecue called the Big Green Egg, which he says he saw a couple of times at 11:75, and it just stuck in his head. And he realized these prizes just repeat. So I'm just going to study all these prizes, memorize all the numbers, and away we go to California.
Terry and Linda aren't the only ones who figured out The Price is Right. A guy named Ted Slauson did it, too, 16 years earlier, but he went home with less than $2,000 in prizes, so I guess it took some luck for Terry to even get to the showcase.
That's one of the reasons I like the story so much, is the idea of preparing for something so rigorously, and yet you still have such a small chance of success. You know, when you go to The Price is Right, there's 300 people in the studio. Only a few will get called down a contestant's row, so that's your first hurdle. Then you get up on stage by hopefully getting a correct bid on something. Then you play your pricing game, and then you confront this giant wheel, the big wheel, which is basically luck. And that's what happened to Ted Slauson. He played the game perfectly, but just ran out of luck at the wheel. And there's nothing you can do about that.
All right, so each episode of The Price is Right ends with the aforementioned showcase where two contestants bid on prize packages worth tens of thousands of dollars. I'm beginning to get that kind of excitement in my voice. I'm sure you can hear it. Terry got to the showcase, and he bid exactly $23,743, which turned out to be right to the dollar. This had never happened before. How did he come up with such an exact bid?
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask Terry says he knew the three prizes. There was a karaoke machine, a pool table, and a camper. Mm-hmm. Added them up to roughly $23,000. And then he claims that 743 was this number based on his wedding date and Linda's birthday and this number that they had used as their PIN and their telephone code and everything like that. And so he, in the heat of the moment, because you don't have much time to bid, he had blurted out $23,743.
Accompanying your Esquire article online is a video clip of Drew Carey, the host of The Price is Right, announcing the showcases. I want to play just a little bit of that now.
Terry, you had the trailer, jukebox, bid $23,743. Actual retail price, $23,743. You got it right on the nose.
Now, to say Drew Carey doesn't sound particularly excited that this has happened would be something of an understatement. Why is that?
Because the show thought they'd been rolled. So the contestants make their bids for the showcase, and then there's a producer named Kathy Greco who has this sacred book of prize values.
And how American!
It's delightful, really. And they convene backstage, and the show had been undergoing some changes right around then. They'd let go of a longtime producer named Roger Dobkowitz, and the producers backstage there, as Terry is dancing to the music on the other side of the flouncy curtain, were worried that Roger had fed the numbers as an act of revenge. So the show had decided that they had been cheated and that this was going to be one of the great quiz show scandals, joining 21 and Press Your Luck. Now, as it happens, Roger Dobkowitz was totally innocent. Terry had either just gotten very lucky or he had prepared or had been helped by Ted in the audience. But for Drew at that moment, he thought, the show is over. I've just lost my job. I'm really mad right now. I don't think the show is going to air anyway. So here, Terry, you can eat on this for a little bit. Funnily enough, when the show finally aired, really the only scandal was that Drew's reaction was so muted, I guess would be the word.
Yeah, that would be the word.
When you know the background, his reaction becomes a little more understandable.
Terry was allowed to keep the prizes. Producers then changed the show by adding more luck, and Terry says the show isn't any fun anymore. But do you think the experience has really changed for the average viewer of The Price is Right?
You hit the nail on the head when you use the word average, Bill. The Price is Right is built on sort of casual viewers, but then a very obsessive group of fans who monitor the show the way satellites watch, you know, military installations, and they get very upset about changes. Something like if they changed the lettering on the Plinko board, this would be an issue. So certain people will watch the show and notice great change. A casual viewer would probably watch and think, oh, that's the same old Price is Right. But it's not. The prizes don't repeat anymore. Trips are now very popular on the show because trips are very hard to guess. It's much more of a luck game now than a skill game. And the people who prided themselves on their skill at that game are, of course, upset that it's just guessing now. It's become something baser.
Chris Jones is a writer for Esquire magazine. His article is titled TV's Crowning Moment of Awesome. Chris, thanks very much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. Of the 2010 British Open, currently underway at fabled St. Andrews in Scotland, it can be said that the poobahs of golf are more than somewhat relieved that perpetual loose cannon John Daly didn't play as well on day two as he did on day one, that the post-poster boy Tiger Woods can three-putt on occasion, and that if your last name begins with 00, you had a terrific first two rounds. the only man ever to even threaten to win a major while carrying a last name that begins with the same vowel repeated, Lewis Wusthuizen finished round two a combined 12 strokes under par. If that form and the form of those in Mr. Wusthuizen's wake holds, he will win the tournament by about 10 shots, and that would certainly be a story. But even if that doesn't happen, day two of the Open will have done its humble part to enhance the lure of this curious game, because yesterday the tournament was suspended for a time on account of wind. You might suppose that this was because drives struck reasonably well off the tee were being blown into the ocean, or into an adjacent sheep meadow, or into the open windows of pubs in nearby hamlets, thereby endangering lads and lasses innocent of any connection with golf. But apparently the wind was interfering with putts, or more precisely, interfering with balls before they could be putted. In golf, there is a rule that goes something like this. If you have addressed your ball on the green and the ball moves as a result of the wind, you will be assessed a one-stroke penalty. If the wind moves your ball on the green before you have addressed it, no such penalty shall be assessed. Contrary to what Art Carney believed some years ago when, as Norton on the old Honeymooners show, he was trying to teach himself golf, addressing the ball does not mean cheerfully saying,
"Hello, ball!"
No, it means standing over the ball and getting ready to hit it with a club by waving said club at it in a more or less menacing way. Why somebody should be penalized if the ball is blown an inch or two by the wind while said somebody is guilty of nothing more than being in the vicinity of the ball with a club in one's hand suggests that at some point some number of people charged with developing the rules of golf became impish or deranged. Of course, this is not to suggest that golf's silly rules are why I don't play the game. I don't play the game because, unlike even the guys who didn't make the cut at St. Andrews yesterday, I couldn't consistently hit the ball straight with any club, whether or not it was windy. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. Extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Practice paid off for Ian Ashmead, who emerged the winner at the 40th World Pea Shooting Championships held on Sunday in Witcham near Ely in the UK. This year, he admitted he has done a bit of practicing because he was determined to come first, said Tracy Robinson, the landlady of the White Horse Pub in the village. She added, in the 2009 contest, Ian only picked up a pea shooter for the first time the night before. The event, which features the use of tripods and laser sights, has been held since 1971. It was begun by John Tyson, a local teacher who figured he ought to do something with all the peas and shooters he'd confiscated from his students. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a consideration of George Steinbrenner and the contemporary ownership model he helped create. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
George Steinbrenner, who due to illness had not been involved in the day-to-day operations of the team he owned for several years, passed away on Tuesday. How should the boss be remembered?
As a gigantic figure in the new age of baseball that began with the fall of the reserve clause in the 1970s, somebody like George Steinbrenner was probably inevitable. And he should be remembered as the guy who rescued the Yankee brand, without which Major League Baseball's pretty much not worth the bother. At the same time, he was an impossible employer. He was petulant. He was temperamental. He was banned from baseball twice. What he tried to do to Dave Winfield is a despicable act. But as somebody once said of Lyndon Johnson, he may have been a son of a bitch, but he was a colossal son of a bitch. He was a huge figure.
Baseball's All-Star Game transpired on Tuesday night. I guess that it would be an exaggeration to say that nobody noticed, but not such an exaggeration compared to other years.
You know, it's the World Cup hangover. Everybody was just so wasted from having watched the World Cup for a month that they didn't want to deal with the baseball.
They realized that after soccer, baseball was boring?
I think it's the lack of vuvuzelas. If they had vuvuzelas at the All-Star game, they might have gotten a 7.7 national rating and a 15 share instead of a 13 share. It's 16% drop from last year. I don't know why, to be perfectly honest with you. There's nothing that's happened in baseball between last year and this year that would cause a drop like that.
The Baltimore Orioles may be the worst team in baseball this year. Cal Ripken is considering a return to the organization. Can that help?
I can't hurt, but unless he's preparing to buy it. The Orioles are afflicted by the most intractable problem in American sports, which is a bad owner. You cannot do anything about it. Unless the bad owner does something really bad in the bad owner's other businesses and winds up in a prison, there's really not much you can do about a bad owner.
Do you think somebody forgot to tell the ownership group led by Boston Celtics minority partner Joe Lacob about NBA Commissioner David Stern's contention that teams are losing money? Because that group just bought the Golden State Warriors for $450 million, outbidding Oracle owner Larry Ellison. The amount is a new NBA record, and you're right. They're terrible.
How can they be
worth that kind of money?
A really bad team in a really kind of weird market just went for $450 million. I'm fairly sure that when David Stern goes abroad and gives speeches to groups of Chinese businessmen, David Stern will point out that one of the mediocre franchises in his league was sold for $450 million and not that the whole league lost $370 million. I'm willing to bet that.
Right.
Way out on the limb.
I'm sure you're right. And of course, the intriguing thing about the math in sports is owners can claim to lose money season after season, but as long as they can sell the team for 10 times what they paid for it somewhere down the line.
Scoreboard!
It's the score at the end of the game that counts, right?
Exactly.
The University of Michigan showed off its $226 million football stadium renovation this week, Charlie. The big house now seats 109,901 people and has reclaimed the distinction of biggest football stadium in the land. Can it be true that the athletic director there still doesn't think the place is big enough?
Well, they're looking for a future expansion, according to Dave Brandon. Of course, they have a little problem. That they have luxury suites and club seats, and 80% of the club seats and 20 of the 81 luxury suites have not been sold yet.
Yeah, but it's a long time till football season, right?
Not at the University of Michigan. It never ends. Are you kidding? At least the marketing end of it.
Apparently undiscouraged by the performance of the French team at the World Cup, the New York Red Bulls are bringing that team's most well-known striker, Thierry Henry, late of Barcelona, to Major League Soccer. Were you surprised at the splash that acquisition made on morning and late-night TV here?
Man, the early show, late night with Jimmy Fallon, this is not bad for a guy who cheated an entire country out of a chance to go to the World Cup. And I'm sure nothing will work out badly because he's playing in New York where there are absolutely no Irish people who will remind him of the handball.
All right, quick quiz, Charlie.
Okay.
What inspired Tour de France course director Jean-François Pechaud to declare, quote, "This is cycling, it's not wrestling"?
Well, apparently, Mark Renshaw of the Australian team decided he was going to run what is apparently a single wing on his bicycle and cleared out the space for the sprinter named Mark Cavendish. Monsieur Pechaud is calling the tactics flagrant and the punishment necessary. There are rules to respect, which will come as a surprise to many of us who follow cycling casually.
No headbutting in cycling.
No headbutting.
Right.
No kicking in the chest either.
No. I read this week that in the average sportscast on Japanese TV, baseball, soccer, and golf all precede the sumo wrestling news. What accounts for the decline in interest in that bastion of traditional Japanese culture?
Well, apparently sumo has become scandal-ridden down through the years. Sumo wrestlers are getting busted for smoking dope, for getting in brawls in bars, hobnobbing with the Yakuza, the widespread Japanese underworld. But my favorite account of the story begins with an Associated Press headline that says, "Scandals expose venerable sumo's shady underbelly." And I can tell you, if you want some shade out of an underbelly, sumo wrestlers is where to go.
That's some serious shade under that belly. And finally, Charlie, over 1,000 Chinese gathered last
week. Can't be wrong.
At Yanbian University to set a record at Group Keepy Uppy. which is basically what?
If soccer's going to take off in this country, it's got to do better with the jargon. Keepy uppy is bouncing a soccer ball up and down on your foot, which is a drill. Can't they find a name for it? Keepy uppy. My amazing thing is that they only found 1,000 Chinese to do this. By Chinese record-setting standards, this is a small group. I'm willing to bet that you could probably triple that by unloading one subway car.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
And keepy uppy.
Never slaughter a chicken in front of a monkey. It's another story.
George Steinbrenner's death on Tuesday may or may not much change the current state of the New York Yankees, the team Steinbrenner had owned since 1973. Poor health prevented him from having much to do with the operation of the team for several years. But while he was still active, George Steinbrenner's flamboyant style, free spending, and occasional disregard for the laws of baseball and man distinguished him from team owners who prefer to accumulate wealth without drawing much notice to themselves. Joining me now to discuss, among other things, the career of the man who had no problem being referred to as the boss is Dave Zirin, whose most recent book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, great to be here, Bill.
You have a personal story about George Steinbrenner that may surprise our listeners. I understand that the boss helped you through, or more accurately, pushed you through, a potentially uncomfortable moment when you were 12.
That is true, and the only reason why this story matters is not that I had a brush with the boss, but only in doing research on Steinbrenner for the book, Bad Sports, did I realize that this story was somewhat evocative. I was living in New York City, and the most pugnacious, polarizing sports columnist in town, a gentleman by the name of Dick Young, passed away. And for reasons that I'm still not quite sure about, I put on my little blue blazer and my bar mitzvah suit, got on the crosstown bus, and decided I would spend my Saturday at Dick Young's funeral. And I showed up, and there weren't really any fans there. The only people at the service were kind of the glitterati of the New York sports scene. And I remember standing there at the doorway, feeling completely like I had no place there. It felt like people were staring daggers through me, although that just could have been my 12-year-old insecurity at the time. But either way, I was frozen in my penny loafers. Next thing I knew, I felt this very rough hand on my back, and I look up, and it's George Steinbrenner, and my jaw hits the floor, and he's looking at me, and he says, here's the guy, now we can get this thing started, and then he pushes me inside the funeral hall. I remember thinking, holy crap, George Steinbrenner just pushed me. It was this bizarre moment that actually has a lot to do with who George Steinbrenner is and how he thought of himself. I mean, he definitely saw himself as a kind of paterfamilias for the entire city. He was also somebody who, as he once told columnist Ira Berkow, he said, I like to inflict fear and pain, but I also like sometimes to inflict joy. I have to tell you, on that day, he inflicted some joy, or at the very least, a little bit of mercy on my 12-year-old self.
In your book, you characterize George Steinbrenner as, quote, a bridge to the past with his larger-than-life personality, but also a bridge to the future. How was the Yankees owner a model for the next generation of owners?
George Steinbrenner was somebody who really owns the patent on a couple of the things that I find most noxious about modern-day ownership, and I think fans find most noxious about modern-day ownership. The first is this idea that you will threaten to move your team unless you get as many subsidies as humanly possible from the city you're in, completely regardless of the state of the city's economy. Now, in the mid-1970s, New York City was in a state of complete and total collapse. And this was when George Steinbrenner said, I need $30 million from the city to refurbish Yankee Stadium, or we're moving. And that $30 million became about $160 million, which in 1976-77 money is a lot. Steinbrenner was the person who really patented that idea. Like when Walter O'Malley said he was going to move the Dodgers from Brooklyn to L.A., he meant he was going to move the Dodgers from Brooklyn to L.A. The other thing he patented, which it just drives me bananas, is this idea that if you own the team, you know more about player personnel, you know more about management than even the savviest GM. That was a Steinbrenner thing as well. And anybody who suffers through Dan Snyder for the Washington Redskins or Jerry Jones for the Cowboys really does know how pernicious it is, an owner who does not know their place.
On the positive side, at least for Yankees fans, George Steinbrenner was, as you write, quote, part of the last group of paternalistic owners who felt it was their duty to plow profits back into the team, creating a brand that the city could be proud of. As you see it, which current owners have most dramatically departed from that business model?
Oh, well, I think without question, I got to think about someone like Dan Snyder, who owns the Washington Redskins. There was a time, not that long ago, 15 years ago, when I moved to Washington, D.C. from the New York City area, when families would actually get in a protracted fight after parents would die about who would get the Redskins tickets. And you could be on a waiting list for years to get in and see the Washington Redskins. You know, this is, I just want to give like a window into what it's like to be a Washington Redskins fan. Did you know that when you go to the bathroom at FedEx Field, where the Washington Redskins play, they try to sell you beer inside the bathroom?
That's so you'll stay in the bathroom and buy more beer.
Exactly. But you know what? This violates every health code since Hammurabi, for goodness sakes. I mean, it is disgusting, and it's just yet another example. Like, Dan Snyder, you literally pay for parking to go to a Redskins game, even if you're not driving there. You pay a parking charge. You pay to actually get from the parking lot to the stadium. I mean, they are, the along with the Cowboys, the two most profitable brands in professional football, which says something about the Redskins, considering they haven't won a damn thing in 20 years. My God, it's been 20 years since they won the Super Bowl. But this has just been a franchise mired in a span of mediocrity to horribleness, made worse by the fact that their owner is just this creature of horrible insecurity. This is not good. This is not good. And a couple others, too, who have taken really important sports brands and destroyed them. Peter Angelos of the Baltimore Orioles, James Dolan of the New York Knicks.
Your descriptions of the business practices of some of the men who currently own Major League franchises almost make George Steinbrenner seem warm and fuzzy in comparison, or am I doing some misreading there?
Well, it's interesting because I don't spare George in the book, despite how good he was to me when I was a prepubescent in penny loafers in a bar mitzvah suit. I am still grateful for that. But let's remember, George Steinbrenner was also the first convicted felon out of Watergate. He was banned from the sport for hiring a 23-year-old clubhouse gopher named Howie Spira, $40,000 to follow Dave Winfield around town and dig up dirt on him just because he didn't want to write a check to Dave Winfield's charity. And so I really think we should resist hagiography or even the most mild of rose-colored glasses, because the boss was who he was. I mean, he was someone who was born on July 4th, as he never tired of telling you, and he was also someone who passed away just in time to both overshadow the All-Star game and avoid paying estate taxes. So from his birth to his death, he lived exactly the way he wanted to live, and there's no reason to put any kind of a shiny bow on that.
The antidote you propose to the outrages and excesses of team owners is public ownership along the lines of the Green Bay Packers model. None of the thousands of people who own shares in the team get rich, and the team will never leave the community, of course. What do you think George Steinbrenner would have made of that suggestion for the future of Major League sports teams?
I think he would have had me drawn and quartered, but that's okay. Because George Steinbrenner and I are probably disagree on a whole host of political questions. But I do know this. I can't imagine that George Steinbrenner wouldn't have felt a little bit repulsed by somebody like Clay Bennett, who moved the Seattle Sonics from Seattle to Oklahoma City. Because George Steinbrenner, yes, he dangled that idea of moving the Yankees, but he never actually did it. Maybe I'm being naive about that. Maybe I'm wearing the rose-colored glasses now. But I feel like this new breed of owner who really, I think they all do on some level, model themselves after Steinbrenner, his business practices, if not his personality. And they really do compromise a kind of collection of cheap facsimiles aimed at short-term profits as opposed to the long-term health and stability of either their teams or their sports. I got to think that while George Steinbrenner would have opposed anything resembling the public ownership model that we see in Green Bay, I can't think he'd be too happy with the current state of affairs either.
Dave Zirin's most recent book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. It's published by Scribner. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me. It's good to have you on the show again.
My privilege, Bill. Anytime.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Esquire writer Chris Jones.
You're not going to believe me, but your book, Baseball Days, was one of the reasons I became a sports writer.
Oh, I am truly sorry, Chris, but let me suggest to you that you also read Prospect, Keepers, Circus in the Woods, and Champions, and then you might think better of the whole thing and become a banker or an insurance agent. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.